All please rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you very much. Y'all can be seated. Thank you. Good morning, y'all, and welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Justices Smith and Kelly and I are glad to have you here today. As you know, we have cause number 0321137CV, ex parte San Jacinto River Authority before the court today. This proceeding is not only being conducted here live at the Third Court of Appeals with a few attendees in the court, but it's also being simultaneously broadcast via YouTube. So hopefully, and it will also be available on the court's website via audio later this afternoon, and it will remain available on our YouTube channel for the public or you to watch later at your own leisure. As you know, we have a time warning system available for the parties here in the courtroom, and I understand the appellants are going to take about 25 minutes, and then, 15 minutes, and then provide it to the other side, the appellees, for 20 minutes, and then rebuttal for five. Wonderful. Thank you very much. And the time warning system will let you know when the yellow light goes on, you have 2 minutes to wrap up your thoughts. When the red light comes on, you'll need to conclude your thoughts at that time. At this point, I'm going to ask that the attorneys introduce themselves to the court and for the record as well. And I'll start with the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Mike Powell, and I'm here for all of the appellants.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Connie Pfeiffer, here with Jim Zucker and Chris Ward, here for San Jacinto River Authority.
All right. Thank you very much.
And I'm Cynthia Morales. I'm here for the Attorney General's Office. We didn't file a brief, but we wanted to make ourselves available.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Much appreciated. And with that, we'll go ahead and begin with Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly.
May it please the court, I would like to focus my time on two of the critical issues that are in this appeal in this expedited declaratory judgment act case. The first question is, did the trial court err by not limiting the first declaration that it entered to declaring that SJRA, the San Jacinto River Authority, validly executed the GRP contracts? Instead of entering a declaration in the passive voice that SJRA and the trial judge interpreted to mean that the GRP contracts were validly executed by all parties to the contracts, including the counterparties to those approximately 80 contracts. Appellants are part of those counterparties. We are among the counterparties. And SJRA's aim here, which they make quite clear in the third paragraph on page 16 of their brief, is to use this trial court order to try to foreclose common law claims and defenses individual counterparties may have when SJRA brings individual breach of contract suits against them in Montgomery County.
So, sir, Mr. Powell, my apologies for interrupting. So I'm looking at Judge Yelenowski's order. So is it correct to say if number one said the GRP contracts were legally and validly executed by SJRA?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Your clients would be pleased.
That is correct, Your Honor. Nobody has ever challenged that SJRA did not legally and validly execute the contracts, with one small proviso, perhaps maybe not a small proviso, what is meant by execution. By execution, we mean, was it properly authorized? Did it have statutory authority to do it? Did the proper person sign the contract? Is it in correct form? Those kinds of things that one would ordinarily take into account when you think of the execution of a contract by one party. SJRA has a much more expansive view of what execution means, including an argument that means that they did not tortiously induce some other party to enter into the contract. That's not part of execution as we see it.
Mr. Powell, isn't the interpretation of what execution means in that order a question for the tribunal, for whatever tribunal would be interpreting what that order means, rather than for our court?
Well, this is the direct appeal from the order, and our view
is
that...
this is a mandamus from the...
No, this order. Is a direct okay. appeal. The style is Ex Parte San Jacinto River Authority, because that's how they caption these EDJA actions in the trial court. But that's sort of confusing, because there's also the style of all of the appellants versus San Jacinto River Authority. It is not a mandamus. It's a direct appeal. And we think that this court has a duty and the right to enter the judgment that the trial court should have entered. It would be far better, in our view, for this court to determine these questions on direct appeal than to have some district court in Montgomery County struggle through them, then have that question go to the Beaumont Court of Appeals and have them try to figure out what the trial judge meant in this case. So,
but,
my apologies, you go ahead.
So, follow. The Supreme Court stated the proper execution is required for a contract to be valid.
Correct.
Because the Supreme Court indicated that it's only the GRP's contract's execution that has the required authorizing connection to the bonds to permit them to qualify as public security authorizations. Doesn't that mean that the validity question here the validity question in EDJA litigation is similarly limited to the valid execution of the contract?
That's what we say, Your Honor. That's our position.
So it's and for the same reason is in the incontestability statute's role in the EDJA. Stumbling over that one. Limited to establishing just valid execution of the GRP contracts.
Well. Yeah, I want to talk quite a bit about that incontestability statute issue, but that's the basis for the trial judge's ruling here. He didn't really look at whether the proper I's were dotted and T's were crossed and that sort of thing. He said, since the incontestability statute's here, it's all valid. Conclusion of law. It determines as a matter of law, as he said in the order. So, the incontestability statutes, I don't think, even come into play in determining whether SJRA properly and legally executed the contract. Those are the kinds of things the Attorney General did look at. The Attorney General requires the bond issuer, in this case SJRA, to send in a transcript which includes a number of different things. We have put as Exhibit D to our handout for oral argument, it's from the record, the regulations of the Attorney General as to what it is that the bond issuer must submit. And you will see that they're all form-type regulations. Citations to the statute that gives the issuer the right to issue bonds. The resolution of the governing board that authorized the issuance of the bonds. The form of the bonds. Those kinds of things. The Attorney General's role in those statutes is to determine whether the Constitution and the statutes governing the issuance of these bonds have been met. If they're not met, then the Attorney General's job is to say, well, wait a minute, you are required to have an election because these are tax-supported bonds.
But on both sides here, not just on your side, it seems like everyone's asking us to interpret what this declaration means from the trial court. And that we need to make a declaration about what this other declaration means, and both parties seem to be arguing what the interpretation of the words and the declarations might mean in future litigation, rather than focusing on whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction to make the declaration in the first place.
Well, that's a good point, because the trial court did not have jurisdiction if it acted outside the scope of the EDJA, and for the reasons we've briefed and I'll discuss, it did not have authority under the EDJA to make declarations about what third parties did. It was limited to declarations about the actions and proceedings of the issuer. And as the Supreme Court said, and as this court said the first time we were here, it is a jurisdictional question if you are in an EDJA case and you're trying to do something for which the EDJA does not provide authority. So there is a jurisdictional question. Our view, I understand what you're saying, and I see the possibility of mass litigation and confusion down the road. if we don't get resolved what this order means. And so on direct appeal, what I would ask this court to do is to enter the order that the trial court should have entered, which you have power to do, and clean it up and clear it up and clear it up in the way we ask you to clear it up so that we won't be litigating this thing. You know, we've been to this court twice, the Supreme Court once already in this case. We'll be litigating these questions till way past my time in this podium.
So, Mr. Powell, in that regard, if we do take that step and declare as you desire, I read number one, and all you're asking is executed by SJRA being added. Then you've got and number two, SJRA has contractual authority under the contracts to issue rate orders and rates that comply with the GRP contracts because those contracts were validly executed by SJRA. Is that all you need is by SJRA?
That's not all we need on that one. I think that one's a very slippery one. It's vague, and if you look at the Supreme Court opinion, there's a sentence at the very end of the Supreme Court's discussion of the compliance declaration. Starts on page 454 of the Supreme Court's opinion. That sentence says, to the extent, first of all, the Supreme Court said you can't have the compliance declaration. There's no jurisdiction under the EDJA to issue the compliance declaration. And then the Supreme Court said, but to the extent the compliance declaration pertains to SJRA's contractual authority to issue a rate order and rates that comply with the GRP contracts, because those contracts were validly executed, SJRA may request a declaration to that effect. So what does to that effect mean? And we say, if you read it in context and apply the rule of the nearest antecedent, that means that they may request the declaration we have already said you may request, and that is that SJRA properly executed the contract, not anything else, not beyond that. I think all the Supreme Court was saying in that sentence was that, correct, if the SJRA did not properly and validly execute the contract, then they do not have authority under that contract to issue rate orders and rates. Mm-hmm. So that's one obstacle, a very early obstacle. And if you find that they validly and legally executed the contract, then that obstacle's at least out of the way. That doesn't get them to where they want to go. So as that declaration is written in the trial court's order, I would ask the court to compare it with the compliance declaration mm-hmm. that the SJRA sought to start with, which the Supreme Court said they could not have. And what I think that declaration does is try to backdoor into the compliance declaration that they wanted to start with. And so I think that needs to be cleaned up too. For example, there's a couple of things there.
And may I interrupt you just another fine point? If, in fact, we agree with you on that, do we even get to the issue of incontestability?
I don't think you do, except I would certainly request that you, if you don't review the trial judge's legal conclusion, that you at least vacate it so we don't have to deal with it in other litigation. So your order, your judgment, should replace that trial court judgment altogether, it seems to me, because he has held in that trial court judgment that the incontestability statutes, as a matter of law, render these contracts legal and valid. That's an erroneous conclusion for all the reasons we've said. Now, he didn't make a declaration to that effect, but it's in there.
It's unusual where it is. It's not a finding.
It is.
It's a conclusion, but it's not a declaration.
We objected to that and said, you know, it's not proper to put that in there, and we lost on that. So.
If it's not in the declarations, then what authority does it have?
Well, I don't know. But that's another one of those things that I don't want some poor district judge in Montgomery County scratching her head over trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do with this. This is an EDJA order, which binds the world. And that's an unusual thing about this order. It is the source of a great, can be the source of a great deal of mischief if it's not very carefully construed or constructed. So our request is that the court basically, as you have, this is all de novo review, that this court enter the judgment that should have been entered in the trial court and basically vacate the trial court's judgment or replace the trial court's judgment with this court's judgment. And I think that's the proper procedural way for the court to go. We've briefed all this, but it seems to me that the issue of whether the trial judge had authority to render a declaration about the actions of the counterparties to these contracts, the 80-some counterparties, is shown to be incorrect right by the statute. And in the first exhibit to our handouts, we've set out the important statutory provisions. It's called excerpts from EDJA sections 1205.001 and 1205.021. The first important thing is the definition of a public security authorization. That is what the trial judge had jurisdiction to render EDJA declarations about, only about public security authorizations. And most of the Supreme Court's opinion is on the question of whether the declarations that SJRA wanted had to do with public security authorizations or not. And the only one that was left was the execution or proposed execution of a contract. But a public security authorization is defined by the statute to mean an action or proceeding by an issuer. It's not defined to mean actions or proceedings by other people, by counterparties to contracts, parties other than the issuer. Here, SJRA is the bond issuer. And then once you get down to the authority to bring the action, the one that's pertinent is number two under that. There are four, but the one that's pertinent is number two. The legality and validity of each public security authorization, which carries, I mean, obviously carries with it the definition of that phrase that comes from 1205.001. And that includes the limitation of a public security authorization to actions and proceedings of the issuer. And so when you get down to the execution or proposed execution of a contract, SJRA's argument, I see my time's up, Your Honor. I think all this is covered in the brief.
If you'll finish that thought, and then we'll get whatever else you need in rebuttal.
SJRA's argument is that, well, it doesn't say the execution or proposed execution of a contract by the issuer. Well, it does, because that's in the definition of public security authorization, and this is just one example of a public security authorization. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Ms. Pfeiffer?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly.
May it please the court. The arguments you just heard are focused on the interests of a very few parties whose interests are diametrically opposed to the rest of SJRA's group of participants, the more than 70 contracting parties who are complying with their contracts, and they're diametrically opposed to the bondholders, who hold more than $500 million in debt secured solely by the very contracts that appellants want to undo. And what I hear Mr. Powell saying is he's trying to give the court an off-ramp to interpret this order so narrowly that it guts the purpose of the EDJA and it guts the purpose of the incontestability statutes so that we have to go relitigate the enforceability and the validity of these contracts in other forums. This has all been decided by Judge Yalinowski, and it should be affirmed by this court. The purpose of the incontestability statutes is that they are designed to protect broader interests that are far broader than just the contracting parties. They protect the interests of the bondholders and the public at large, the taxpayers, ratepayers, and the ordinary citizens who benefit from the public works projects that are financed by public bonds. That's why incontestability can be decided by declarations under the Expedited Declaratory Judgment Act is because it affords a judgment that holds that the contracts are valid and incontestable by anyone and thereby protects the public security and these broad interests. Note that the Expedited Declaratory Judgment Act, that's just the nickname of the statute. The actual title is public security declaratory judgment actions. This statute is the legislature's means of protecting public securities.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Sure.
I mean, what would happen to the bonds and all this stuff if these contracts were deemed unenforceable?
Then the means of repaying these bonds goes away, because the contracts at issue here are the sole source of payment for the bonds. So the revenues from the contracts are pledged to repay the bonds, and they cannot raise taxes. SJRA has no taxing authority, and there's no ability to come up with some other way of repaying the bonds. So what that means is that the bondholders, and over $400 million of this is held by the Texas Water Development Board, which is the state of Texas, would have no recourse. I mean, it's extraordinary what's being asked of the courts here to try to undo contracts that are pledged to secure public bonds. And it's not just this case. This is a much, much bigger issue, because this is a very common way of issuing or securing public debt in Texas. So you can do it with taxes, you can do it with rates and things like toll roads, but contracts whose revenues are pledged to secure public bonds is a very common way of handling this. And that's why the incontestability statutes speak not just to the incontestability of the bonds themselves, but also the contracts.
As I posed to Mr. Powell, Ms. Pfeiffer, aren't all these issues that you're talking about, undoing the contract, isn't that all something for a judge in another court to unravel at the end of the day?
Respectfully, no. And here's why. It's because what we're talking about now is not private contract rights. We're talking about special contracts. These are contracts whose revenues are pledged to secure public bonds. These are public rights, and you can decide these public rights through an in rem action. That's what the EDJA does, is it's an in rem action. That's why you don't have to have all the parties here, because we're deciding the legality and the validity of the res, or the thing. And I think one of the best ways this court can get its arms around this case is by really closely studying this court's prior opinion. There's so much there that already discusses these issues, and I think is a very solid analysis, and was largely affirmed by the Texas Supreme Court. So we've included that in the bench exhibits with some key passages highlighted. But Justice Pemberton explained that what they're talking about in this case are not private contract rights. We're not trying to litigate breach. We're not trying to litigate anybody's ability to challenge rates. The courts have already decided that's not available under the EDJA, because those are private rights. But public rights, when we're talking about the legality and the validity of these types of contracts that secure public bonds, those can be litigated as a in rem action under the EDJA. So the appellants want to wipe out these contracts. They're really trying to not just challenge the enforceability, but ask for rescission, ask that the contracts be set aside. They cannot do this for three reasons. First, the incontestability statutes foreclose anyone from contesting contracts that have been approved to repay public securities. Second, appellants have no constitutional challenge to the incontestability statutes, and all their constitutional doubt arguments do not apply, because they're not here arguing that the statutes are ambiguous. They're just making constitutional arguments in the abstract to argue for some narrowing interpretation, and that's not a valid statutory interpretation. And third, both this court and the Texas Supreme Court have held that the validity of the contracts can be decided by declaration under the EDJA. That's this court's prior opinion at Star 676, and in tab A of our bench of exhibits, we've included the Supreme Court passage at Star 454. The easiest way to process this case, I think, is to just understand exactly what has been decided, and I think I can make the decisional path a little bit easier by orienting the court to where we've been and where we are now. This suit, we filed this under the EDJ in 2016, and it has been anything but expedited, because it's gone up to the courts twice now. But this really started off as a rate dispute. In 2016, Mr. Powell's clients decided they didn't like the new rates under these contracts, and so they wanted to stop paying the rates, and we came to court to say, we think we can get all of this decided at once. What we learned in the courts of appeals is that we cannot litigate the rates and whether they're in breach of contract. But we can get declarations saying that the contracts themselves are legal and valid, so that when this goes back to Montgomery County for a breach of contract trial, we're not litigating fraud claims and rescission claims, we're litigating just breach of contract claims.
And so if I can interrupt, so it's your position that the if there is a dispute over the rates or the rates are not being calculated in accordance with the contract, those claims can still be brought
exactly
in some future time.
That's right.
But the contract themselves are still valid and there, and you're arguing over the terms of the contract and whether they're being applied for the rates. Is that?
Well, I would agree precisely with the first part of what you said,
okay,
that what this court in an EDJA action can affirm and what Judge Yalanowski has decided is that these GRP contracts are valid and incontestable. They're public security authorizations. These are contracts pledged to secure the validity of bonds. And under the EDJA, you can declare the contracts are legal and valid. Then in other lawsuits, we can go litigate whether anybody's in breach of contract. And they have all the rights to challenge breach and the rates. So what's being decided in this case is simply the public right of securing these contracts so that the bonds are protected.
Ms. Pfeiffer, the incontestability statute says valid, binding, and enforceable according to the contract's terms. So what's the import or the effect of the language according to the terms?
In which statute are you reading?
In the incontestability statute.
Is it the 1202-006?
I don't know.
Well, and
that's not in my notes,
that's
Ms.
okay.
Pfeiffer.
Well, and I will tell you, I mean, what's kind of remarkable here, we've got three incontestability statutes that apply. They're maybe slightly different wording. One's under the water code, two are under the government code. They're slightly different wording. I don't think that's material. Every court that's looked at this, including this court and the Texas Supreme Court, has recognized all three apply. And so your question, I want to make sure
it
I
just
answer.
Says it's valid, binding, and enforceable according to the terms of the contract, essentially is what the language says.
Yes.
So what is the impact of that language according to the terms of the, according to the contract's terms? Like, what effect does that have? What does that mean?
Well, the way I understand it is it means that these contracts, no provision of the contracts and the contracts as a whole could be set aside and challenged as unenforceable. The contracts are now sacrosanct. They're set in stone. And so once you go through this process of submitting these contracts to the Attorney General, and we've put in our bench exhibits where City of Conroe, we've just used them as an example, have certified to the Attorney General that their executions were all duly authorized and valid, that they had no pending litigation, that they've duly approved these and complied with all formalities. So the Attorney General then approves these contracts, and that's the basis for the comptroller registering the bonds and issuing the bonds, and then that's when all the money happens. So you have to go through this very formulaic process to assure the bondholders that these contracts will never be set aside. They're incontestable. So the source of revenue for repaying the bonds is not going anywhere. And you don't have to worry about what a jury would do or what results would happen in different lawsuits. This will all be once and for all incontestable.
But isn't the Attorney General's review of the bonds and the contracts just looking at the validity and legality of their execution? I mean, how can the Attorney General know whether the counterparty's execution of their contracts were valid and legal if they're, you know, just because they're in the box, quote unquote, right? That's the appellant's language. Just because all these contracts are in the box that are taken over to the Attorney General's office and the Attorney General gives its stamp of approval, how can the Attorney General know whether or not counterparties' executions of contracts are valid and legal?
It's ministerial, and the Attorney General is relying on the certifications
okay
that are put before them. So City of Conroe's city attorney executed a certification, it's in the bench exhibit, saying this was all duly authorized and legally done and there's no litigation pending. So the Attorney General is not conducting some sort of judicial review and going beneath those certifications. But it's much like in the commercial context, a waiver of reliance in a contract. When sophisticated parties sign a waiver of reliance, this is the whole Italian cowboy, forest oil, Schlumberger line of cases where courts will say, you as a sophisticated party can disclaim reliance on your counterparty's statements and you can never come back and sue for fraud or fraudulent inducement. You've waived that right. That's what happens here. When they go to the Attorney General and certify that this was all done validly, they're waiving the right to come back to court and say, oh, now we want out because we think we were fraudulently induced. They don't have that right.
So do you think that the cities are reading the language in the declaration too expansively? I mean, in part of their argument is now people will never be able to contest all of these hundreds of contracts and in theory could be in this box that was taken to the Attorney General's office. Are you saying that's too expansive? We're not even making that argument here?
Well, I think I understand your question. I would actually say they're reading the declarations too narrowly because they're trying to read them as literally just the signature on the page is valid and that's it. And we are saying, and if this is how they're characterizing our argument, I would agree with them. We are saying these declarations will operate as an injunction to the entire world that nobody can come back and challenge these contracts. That's the whole point of the EDJA, is to get a judgment that forecloses this issue from being litigated among different parties.
For every reason.
Forever.
Even if it's void against, you know, if it should be void against public policy, if there's some other illegality, in your view, incontestability stops all of that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And there's nothing extraordinary about that, right? I mean, I realize that sounds very, very broad, but that's the whole point of an in rem judgment and declaration, as you're saying, as to the whole world. Taxpayers can't come and challenge this. Mr. Powell couldn't sign up new clients and come and challenge this. Everybody is going to be bound by the declaration saying these are valid and legal contracts. And I'd like to, there's one point I'd really like to emphasize that is not answered in the reply brief. We've identified 27 statutes in Texas that are incontestability statutes that all relate to bonds that are pledged, including pledges of revenues from contracts, many in the public infrastructure context. Of those 27 statutes, only 7 have exceptions for fraud and forgery. The rest of them don't, and the ones at issue in this case don't. They're very absolute bars on ever contesting the contract. So 1202006 that we're relying on in this case was amended in 1999 to remove a fraud exception. So what Mr. Powell is essentially arguing is for a judicial exception for fraud or fraudulent inducement or some defenses, common law defenses, to try to declare a contract unenforceable, that the legislature has not provided and that the legislature has actually removed in the applicable statute for this case. That's extraordinary. That's a really a reach of a position, and there's nothing in the reply brief answering this point. I'd love to hear today what he would say about the fact that incontestability statutes are used all over. In insurance contracts, they're used. In trademark, they're used. These are very common concepts, but there is no exception for fraud or forgery, and they're trying to get that through the courts. I'd like to just briefly touch on the constitutional avoidance issue, because we've seen a lot in their briefs about, oh, if the court were to interpret it the way SJRA would like, well, that would make it unconstitutional. They are not bringing a constitutional challenge to these statutes. So they haven't made this direct claim, and in the Texas Supreme Court, the court was very on top of that and pinned Mr. Powell down and said, you're not bringing a constitutional challenge. And he said, that's right, we're not yet. And they haven't amended their pleadings to ask for that. So what they're doing is actually an improper statutory interpretation by saying, well, apply this constitutional doubt canon to narrow this interpretation to just this very narrow reading of what execution would mean. Well, you only apply a constitutional doubt canon where the statute's ambiguous. And if there were two reasonable interpretations, one unconstitutional and one constitutional, then courts will pick the constitutional interpretation. The whole canon that they're talking about doesn't apply here because they're not arguing that these incontestability statutes are ambiguous. They're not. They're very plain and they're very absolute. And so all the constitutional arguments that I find very dense can be disposed of just on this principle alone, to say there is no ambiguity here. We don't need to reach constitutional arguments, although our brief does give full answers for each one of them. Finally, I'd like to just touch on execute, because this does seem to be where they're really leaning. They're trying to do a lot of work through that one word. And I think in their interpretation of execute, it's the act of picking up the quill and dipping it in the ink and putting it on paper with authority, and that's it. And that's not the common understanding or the legal dictionary definition of execute. Black's Law Dictionary says that it's validation of a written instrument, such as a contract, by fulfilling the necessary legal requirements. And the Texas Supreme Court, when addressing this issue, cited the Baylor case and says, as we have long held, contracts must be properly executed to be valid. They're talking about the broader concept of the enforceability of the contract. So execute is not just the signature, execute is the making a contract valid. And in a bilateral contract, that means both parties coming together to make it valid.
But can't a contract be executed by a party with the authority to execute a contract but still be unenforceable for other reasons?
In private contracts, yes. I would agree with you. I think that's what is key about this case, is these aren't just mere private contracts. These are contracts that have now been reviewed and approved by the Attorney General and certified by the comptroller. I mean, the comptroller doesn't just certify the bonds. If you read, and this is in our bench exhibits as well, at tab G, the comptroller certifies the proceedings that have been submitted to the Attorney General. So you talk about your box. That whole box is certified and now part of this whole validation of the public security. So that's what makes these public rights contracts in part. We still think there's private rights to go litigate breach, but there's not any private right to litigate enforceability. So I see my time's about to expire. I want to make sure I've answered all the court's questions about this. This is a really important case. It's not just $500 million in this case. This is obviously law that will be used and applied in other cases. And I think part of the reason you don't see a lot of case law on these incontestability statutes is because there's not a lot of people challenging these. This was sort of a pre-World War II topic, and these statutes are so plain, we don't see a lot of challenges in the modern era to incontestability statutes. So I think that the key here is to write an opinion that not only affirms Judge Yalinowski's declarations, which, as we've shown in tab A, come straight from what the Supreme Court said he could declare. I mean, verbatim, he's taking the words from the Supreme Court opinion and saying, I have authority to make these declarations. But also affirm his reasoning, which, just as Kelly, you noted, the statement in the order about the role of the incontestability statutes in EDJ litigation, is the reasoning based on this summary judgment record showing all the proceedings that were submitted and that make these public contracts, that is why these contracts are now legal and valid and incontestable.
Then, but if I may,
ahead.
I apologize
course,
for not
yes,
doing this
Judge.
Earlier, Chief. So what then do you make of the new language after the motion for rehearing in the Supreme Court's new opinion in City of Conroe versus San Jacinto, where they added, and this is at 456, their conclusion, where they mm-hmm. added SJRA's execution,
right,
in the new opinion. So what was the purpose? I mean, I think that's
their
main argument on the other side is, listen, obviously we should get this language because the Supreme Court said in their opinion that we should get this language.
Well, so if you actually go through the Supreme Court's opinion and know all the different places where it talks about execution of the contracts, there's about five other places where they don't refer specifically to SJRA. And so if we're just counting references, we certainly win that count. But when they added it in at that one spot,
it was very intentional.
Right. I think that's right. And it looks like what they're doing is trying to emphasize the contrast between declarations regarding contract validity and the compliance declaration that they said we could not get. So they're saying you can get this, you can't get that, and they're trying to make that more clear. But, you know, the appellants
made it less clear.
Right. I mean, I understand why that now seems confusing. But I will say Mr. Powell also asked the court to change the language in the conclusion, and they didn't. So I don't think you can put too much weight into that. And I would encourage the court to just step back and look at this from a big picture public policy analysis of what is this whole statute trying to do, and does that do these holdings comport with this bigger public policy of protecting the public security and declaring the contracts valid and enforceable?
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Piper.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly.
First, just consider what my friend just told you. She didn't focus much when she started out on the execution of the contract. She tells you that the purpose of this order is to establish the validity of the contracts, not the validity of SJRA's execution of the contracts. The Supreme Court went all through that. The validity of the contracts is not a proper EDJA subject. The statute says the execution or proposed execution of a contract, not the validity of the contract. All the other examples given are sort of in the same form. The imposition of a rate, not the rate itself, but the process by which the bond issuer imposed the rate. The Supreme Court makes that clear in its opinion. The pledge or encumbrance of a tax, not the tax itself, but this one specific action that was taken by the issuer in conjunction with these bonds. Now let me, you know, there's always a parade of horrible hypotheticals in this case. SJR says the sky's falling. If you don't rule for us, and they've said this in every, this is the fifth appeal I've argued on these subjects. In every case, their main argument is the sky will fall unless you do what we want you to do. The first answer is that's not true. 60% of the revenues they get are used to, and they admit this in their pleadings, are used to fund the bonds. The other 40%, which is the 40% that we fuss about, the prolific spending that they use on the other 40%, is what we're fighting about. The bonds are insured. I mean, you know, if anybody's going to get hit here, it's an insurance company. It's not the Water Development Board. It's not the bondholders, that sort of thing. But I don't think all of that is really before Your Honor. This is a legal question on the proper interpretation of two sets of statutes, the EDJA number one and the incontestability statutes number two. That's what this case is about as it is presented to Your Honors today. Let me talk about the incontestability statutes. I didn't get to say all I wanted to say about those. Think of two different situations: the incontestability of the bonds and the incontestability of contracts that a bond issuer has entered into to raise money to pay off the bonds. That comes up all the time. I've spent a lot of my career litigating around DFW Airport in Dallas. There are all kinds of contracts there, the revenues from which are pledged to support the bonds that were issued to build that airport. The restaurants, the bookstores, you know, the hotels that are on the airport property, the use agreements with the airlines. If just because those contracts were the revenues from them are pledged to secure bonds, and the contracts were put in a huge box or on a huge disk and sent to the Attorney General, doesn't mean that those contracts are, quote, incontestable by the parties who entered into them. The restaurateur, the bookstore owner. Those people are not bound by that Attorney General process. They can't be. We can't be. You know, the 80 different counterparties, some of which are school districts, little towns, big towns like Conroe, industries. We are not a party to that Attorney General business. And to say that the Attorney General's approval of the contracts, and I would encourage you to look at what the Attorney General says, and that's Exhibit C, he doesn't examine any facts. He takes the facts that the issuer provides to him. And then he supposedly, under their theory, issues some kind of a massive, super powerful res judicata, unheard of in any case or any treatise that I've found in this state, that bars the counterparties to those contracts from challenging those contracts. That is a gross violation of the separation of powers. The Attorney General can't do that. That's a judicial function. It is a violation of due process. We didn't have notice. We didn't get a hearing. We have no right to judicial review of what the Attorney General's staff did and when they signed the Attorney General's name after they checked all the boxes and said, yeah, they've got statutory authority. This doesn't rely on tax money for payment, so there didn't have to be an election, all those kinds of things. So it would be a violation of that. It would deprive us of jury trial, all those things we've said in our brief, if you were to construe those incontestability statutes to apply to a third party, as opposed to the first parties, which are the bondholder and the issuer. That's what the real issue is here. We're kind of a third wheel in that deal. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. The case is submitted, and we'll be back with you soon. Thank you very much. Court will stand in recess.